right, folks, I am Jake Mosier, and this is the Super Mosier Brothers Show, a podcast where two brothers and best friends take their lifelong passion of talking about video games away from the family dinner table and to the microphone. I am joined by no one today. It's just me, as slightly promised by our Twitter account. As I've talked about now multiple times, as Sam's talked about, Sam has had an abundant of travel due to work. And frankly, when you're gone for 5 days and you have such limited free time, I gave him a pass. I said, take a nap, go hang out with some friends, don't sit at a desk with me and talk about video games. But that doesn't mean that I don't want to talk about video games. I sent out a poll for our audience to vote on what game I should try to beat in a week. What were those games? Those were Vanquish from 2010, Mirror's Edge from 2008, Papers, Please from 2013, and Overboard! Exclamation point from 2021. Those are all games that I've had on my backlog for varying ranges of time, and I knew I had a slow week ahead, and I thought it would be fun to do the review episodes. I love getting an opportunity to look at a game in an in-depth lens. Just due to Sam and I's lives, we don't have an opportunity to do that together very often. And it's very hard to align on what we're in the mood to play. So if I have an opportunity to do so, why not? And so people voted. They voted on Mirror's Edge. And I was able to beat it. I beat Mirror's Edge a few hours ago. And I will talk about it for our main topic. But outside of that, how are y'all doing? How's life? If you're younger and you're in school, are you on spring break? Has that been refreshing? Has it been awful? Have you had to go home? Do you not like being home? Are you going out with friends every night? Is it super fun? I hope so. I hope life is good. If you're an adult and you're working, I hope things are relatively slow. I hope you're getting to enjoy warmth. If there's warmth where you're at, it's been fluctuating in good old Missouri. But either way, thank you so much for listening. Let's get into some housekeeping. Our news stories this week. I'm going to be briefly talking about the Dragon's Dogma 2 microtransaction controversy. And then I will be hopping in to Marathon, Bungie's confirmed next game. I say rumored because they are in a state of crisis, it sure seems like, every time we get an article that relates to anything going on at the company. So I'll be diving into the recent creative change there and how I feel about their future. For our main topic, as I just said, I'll be talking about Mirror's Edge and sharing all my opinions on the 2008 cult classic. I think it's technically still a cult classic. Thank you to anyone who's listening. It means so, so much. If you enjoyed this show, please subscribe to it in your podcast. Please leave us a review, share it with your friends. It would mean the galaxy to me. It would mean the galaxy to Sam. It would mean the galaxy to probably someone else out there. I don't know why, but there's a chance. You never know. Maybe they really like the graphic of our podcast. Maybe they really hate one of us. And it would bring them joy for you to be able to engage in discourse with them about how much you hate the podcast. I don't fucking know. Let's get into it. My first story comes from Game Informer, written by, love when the ad has to reload, Marcus Stewart. Headline reads, Capcom addresses Dragon Dogma 2 PC performance and microtransaction backlash. Dragon's Dogma 2 is one of the year's most anticipated games, and by most accounts, the experience lives up to the hype. The game earned rave reviews from most critics, including a 9 out of 10 from Game Informer. But now that it's out in the wild, Steam players have bombarded the RPG with negative reviews due to its problematic launch performance and day one microtransactions. In terms of performance problems, Steam players have reported issues such as frame rate drops, freezes, and crashes. Capcom has acknowledged these issues in a Steam blog post where it says, quote, to all those looking forward to this game, we sincerely apologize for any inconvenience, end quote, and adds, we are investigating, fixing critical problems such as crashes and freezing. We'll be addressing crashes and bug fixes starting from those with the highest priority in patches in the near future. In regards to the frame rate issues, Capcom writes, a large amount of CPU usage is allocated to each character and calculated the impact of their physical presence in various areas. In certain situations where numerous characters appear simultaneously, the CPU usage can be very high and may affect the frame rate. We are aware that in such situations, letting that reduced GPU load may currently have a limited effect. However, we are looking into ways to improve performance in the future. The console versions, this is now back to Game Informer's writing, have their own framerate issues, as noted in a review by writer Jesse Vitelli, who noted, quote, large-scale battles are where you'll see the performance on consoles take a big hit. When I had multiple enemies on screen and a pawn would cast a big spell, the frame rate dripped tremendously. The game's microtransactions have also drawn ire. In addition to selling Rift Crystals, the game's currency, fans are upset the game sells useful exploration gear, such as Port Crystals, fast travel points that you can place in a chosen destination, parentheses, though you still need another item, Fairy Stones, to use it, which aren't for sale. Capcom is also selling the Art of Metamorphosis book, an item that allows players to redesign their character and revive items, parentheses, Wake Stones. You can purchase all these items at once in the, quote, A Boon for Adventurers New Journey Pack bundle, which comes included in the game's deluxe edition. Capcom addressed these complaints in the same blog post, pointing out that the following items can be obtained through normal gameplay. If you want extra quantities of any of those items, you have the choice of paying real money for them instead of getting them the old-fashioned way, so they basically serve as optional convenience skips. While it's absolutely understandable why players would be annoyed regardless, this is actually quite normal for Capcom titles. The recent Resident Evil and Monster Hunter games, for example, all offer microtransactions of similar scope and have faced comparatively minimal, if any, pushback. Still, fans are taken aback by their appearance in Dragon Dogma 2, and without context for how rare or easy to obtain these items are, some players believe the game's intentionally challenging slash inconvenient design aims to push players towards these purchases to ease the experience. Others simply cite the age-old argument that full-price games, $70 in Dragon Dogma 2 case, should not charge additional money for in-game items at all. Combined with the aforementioned performance issues, disgruntled players have flooded the game with bad reviews to the point that it currently has a, quote, mostly negative Steam rating just hours after launch. Despite this initially chilly reception, it doesn't appear Capcom will alter its monetization plans for now. That was a lot of info. To sum it up, people are upset with performance and the microtransactions. Those have resulted in a lot of negative Steam reviews. I don't have much of a take on the performance issues. I don't think there's much of a take to have there. Performance issues uniformly always suck. I wish games could come out fully finished, fully functioning for everyone involved, and it is unfortunate that that is not the case. I hope that gets patched as soon as possible. In terms of my excitement for this game, it was mild until reviews came out. Not just, oh, they are high reviews, I want to play this. Specifically diving into what the reviews liked about this game, what the critics liked about this game. Talking about the kind of deconstruction of the now typical open world genre. If you go back to earlier open world games, some of the things this game might be criticized for, some people, lack of fast travel, lack of what some people might just call quality of life things, are just not in this game. But I think some of those things is what made the original open world genre more appealing. And here's why. You play an open world game, there are two things I go for. The actual act of traversing that open world, giving a player a huge area to explore, is actually engaging. That can either mean traversal is engaging, which is like the first reason why I can go to an open world game. Dying Light 2, Spider-Man, it feels great to just run around. Maybe not what you're finding is all that exciting, but the actual movement feels good to be let loose in this playground. Or option number two, what you are finding, doing, encountering along that way is engaging. And that seems to be where Dragon's Dogma 2 really excels. It sounds like the moment-to-moment adventure part of Dragon's Dogma 2 is fantastic. The chance encounters with enemies, the perils at nighttime, all that stuff sounds like what I like in an open-world game, which is, hey, no, this isn't about checking off a bunch of, like, boxes. This isn't about using fast travel to get to everywhere where you can as quickly as possible so you can jump to the next main story beat or jump to the collectible you need and then fast travel to somewhere else. I like getting to live in the world. I like it. That's why I love Breath of the Wild and Tears of the Kingdom. I like looking at a point and saying, I'm going to go there. Even though fast travel does exist in Tears of the Kingdom, I never really wanted to use it. I found it much more compelling to keep running because I always knew I was going to find an interesting side quest, an interesting enemy, an interesting item for myself. And it sounds like this game is similar in that way. Which then kind of dovetails me into the conversation about the microtransactions. I'm very excited for this game. I will be getting it, hopefully, once the performance stuff is fixed. The microtransactions aren't a problem in my head if you know the context around this game and this franchise. That's where this conversation gets a little difficult. I don't expect the everyday typical consumer to know that Dragon's Dogma 2 is designed in a way that is different than other open world games. It is not built to, like, push you towards paying for fast travel via microtransactions. That is just how the game is designed naturally. It's how the first one was designed. One of the designers has come out and said, if your game has frequent fast travel, your open world is most likely boring. He has outright like stated that that is something that they want to do in these games, is to make exploration rewarding and interesting. And obviously I know that, so I don't really get put back by the microtransactions. I think it's kind of funny that it's like, well, if you don't like the way we designed the game, yeah, sure, pay more money to get around it. I get it that for some people, and maybe for most people, that the way that should be handled is just as, hey, there's one vendor in the game, or even like an accessibility turn on or off setting within the settings that gives you a ton more fast travel points, gives you a ton more, what are the other options here in the article we had? So it allows you to change your character more often, allows you to escape from caves and such, things like that. Maybe they should just put that in the accessibility settings and it allows people to play the way they want. And I think this comes to a larger conversation that happened a few years ago around Souls games, around accessibility and design, in that there's a camp of people that argue that if you put accessibility options, and accessibility means a wide variety of things, so I'm trying my best to not use that as a blanket term, but I am happy to engage in this conversation with anyone else in a more in-depth way if you'd like to. Souls games having accessibility settings, and how if you added the accessibility settings, it would ruin the original artistic intention that the designers had when creating the game, that if you could go in and make the enemies just do significantly less damage and have you significantly more damage or slow down the enemies, etc., that it breaks the original design of the game and their artistic intent is now ruined. I think that is an interesting conversation to have, but I do think there's a difference between accessibility and fundamentally changing the game. I think like you can definitely probably add some good accessibility stuff so that people who have disability issues are allowed to play those games. I also think maybe most importantly, and this is where like I ultimately still fall on the line of microtransactions, not the best. Let's use the Dragon's Dogma thing as the example. So let's say you remove the microtransactions and you put it into your settings that, hey, if you want more fast travel points, turn on this setting. We're going to give you a ton. You're going to be able to fast travel whatever time you want. That's still optional. It is not something that you're forcing the players to do. People can still play the game the way it was intended. Now, the creator might argue that, hey, I don't want people playing it that way. That's not the way I intended the game to be played. And I think this microtransaction thing is a weird kind of fucked up version of like, well, you can do it. You got to pay a little bit more for it because I'm not really happy about it. That's obviously not why they're doing it. They're doing because the research shows that people are going to buy this. They're going to make money from it. And it's going to be a secondary source of funds for Capcom to continue making games. Not that they would, they'll still make games whether these are here or not. I've gotten way off track. To try to summarize what I've been saying, I don't think this is worth the review bombing and large controversy that's been had over the past few days. One, they're relatively inexpensive. I'm looking at the Steam page now, and like the Wake Stone, which is classified as, I really wish this was listed out. The Wake Stone is Restore the Dead to Life, so I'm going to presume that is some sort of revive feature. It's 99 cents. The Rift Crystals, which is not described what it is here, those are 99 cents. It ranges from max 2.99 to at the lowest 99 cents. Those aren't egregious. And two, as I've kind of already stated, they aren't needed. Everyone who reviewed this game, or 99% of people that reviewed this game, did not mention the microtransactions because they did not use them. They did not need them. They thoroughly enjoyed the game without them present. So I think like the huge ire being thrown around at these microtransactions, especially ones that really aren't that egregious, is unnecessary. There are a lot more price there's a lot more price gouging going on across other games that I'm a lot more concerned about than this with Dragon's Dogma 2. Do I think they're necessary? No, I think you could just remove them, and people who buy the game and don't love it just don't get more fast travel points, and that's fine. But I also, like, you don't have to buy them. You can just play the game. And I am not the one to speak on this, but it feels different than a loot box, which I understand the then predatory gambling side of that, where it's like, well, they don't really know what they're getting, and there's kind of that, there's that serotonin hit when you open a box and it's a surprise. I don't think that, like, argument holds up here either, because it's a single-player game. You're not leveling up or really, this isn't really benefiting you a ton. So I don't think it is exploitative of its players. It is giving them another way to play the game if they want to pay more, which they do not need to. Again, microtransactions not necessary. This doesn't need to be here. But this, I mean, it feels like an afterthought for a reason. The game was made, and then Capcom was probably like, well, we need something. We put microtransactions on all of our games. What can we put here? It's like, some people might not like the fast travel. Let's put it in there. I don't think it was designed around this at all. From all their interviews, it doesn't sound like it was. So I think it's kind of a lot to do about nothing. But alas, I would love to hear your thoughts. Are you frustrated by the microtransactions? Do you think it is a good decision? I don't know. I don't really know. It's an interesting conversation to have. Moving on to the second story, IGN... written by Rebecca Valentine. Bungie shakes up Marathon leadership, removing Chris Barrett as game director. Amid ongoing anxiety within Bungie following layoffs last year, the studio is now preparing for another shakeup, this time on Marathon, its upcoming service game intended as its next step beyond Destiny. According to multiple sources familiar with the matter, Bungie is in the midst of shifting around its creative leadership on Marathon, including removing longtime Bungie designer Christopher Barrett from the game director role. IGN learned he is replaced by former Valorant game director Joe Ziegler, who left Riot Games for Bungie in 2022. IGN has reached out to Bungie for comment on whether or not Barrett will remain with the company. Bungie has not yet responded to IGN's request for comment, but shortly after he reached out, Ziegler confirmed his appointment as game director on Twitter. "For the last 9 months, I've been working on Marathon as the game director," he wrote. "We're still baking, but I'm excited to share with you more info on the game as we get closer and closer to bringing it all to you." While this is going on, sources tell IGN that Bungie is pouring resources into getting Marathon out the door. The game's direction has shifted somewhat under Ziegler's new leadership, one source says, including moving away from custom player characters in favor of a selectable cast of heroes. While upcoming Destiny 2 expansion The Final Shape is also being prioritized, there are growing fears and rumors that layoffs will immediately follow its release. One person with knowledge of budgets at Bungie told me that, quote, "nothing adds up, and something will need to happen to curb costs unless The Final Shape does so well to cover the gap and people can move to Marathon." I kind of stuttered with my words there, so to re-clarify, something will need to happen to curb costs unless The Final Shape does so well to cover the gap that people can move to Marathon, end quote. While Sony acquired Bungie, the studio brought with it a number of other incubation projects, including a mobile-like game codenamed Gummy Bears, that's fun, and a new IP known as Matter. According to sources, Matter was canceled back in 2020, but the team continued working on a smaller project with slightly different direction until that too was canceled in late 2022. Gummy Bears, meanwhile, is currently in a holding pattern due to the ongoing company struggles. Within the company, there is a growing expectation that senior company leadership will leave in droves in the summer of 2026 when the final payouts from Sony's acquisition of the company take effect. With this in mind, there is a strong push to get Marathon out the door before then and let whoever takes the reins after that, be it Sony or Bungie, worry about how it's sustained. There's a lot more information later on in the article. Go give Rebecca Valentine and IGN the click about what's happened with Bungie over the last 2 years after the acquisition by PlayStation, after all the layoffs they had, after the kind of crisis moment, realizing what the sales of the last Destiny expansion did and how that would affect their future. This news is really interesting for many reasons. I want to start with the Marathon stuff before we get into the large-scale Bungie problems. Going from a custom character creator to a hero game to a, as they put it in the article, a selectable cast of heroes, has the potential to be a really big change. I think about older Call of Duties where you're not, there's no classes, you're just like picking a character, you're not really designing him either, that's kind of something separate. But it's, hey, you have your character and you're going into the match. It's less about customization, which this seemed to be doing, was like you have your player that you have created and you're going into the world of Marathon. Personally, that idea, creating your own character, having your guy that you get new shit for and are constantly developing over the course of a game, is much more interesting than a selectable cast of heroes. This is like a really disappointing fundamental change for the game for me. I have found most cast of heroes very typical, iterative, uninventive. Overwatch is the only cast of heroes game that I have thoroughly enjoyed. I think Apex Legends are okay. Most others, not very compelling. I think that is one, if you do it right, it is a reason to bring you into the game. It is something that compels you to get to see these amazing characters full of personality in action. But frankly, I think that's really, really hard to do. Because once you remove what I think is one of the best parts about video games, which is like putting yourself in the shoes of another character. When you're playing a single-player game and you're never interacting with other players besides talking to people in the real world, go and talk to your friend like, oh, I'm playing Ghost of Tsushima, this was really cool, you feel pretty isolated in what's happening. In a game like Marathon, if you have a selectable cast of heroes, the second you see someone else in that character, it, for me, it kind of breaks the experience in a way, especially if this is supposed to be a living, breathing game. I lose some of that excitement and investment unless the cast of heroes is phenomenal. And maybe they can nail it. I don't know. A game designed around a cast of heroes is very different than a game designed around you pick your character. And maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it is the same fundamental game, and instead of creating a character at the beginning, you choose between 20 characters that have like pre-designed costumes and voices, and that's it. And that's how it goes. And that's okay. It's not what I want, but that's fine. I don't understand how that would be a necessary change, in that if your characters aren't bringing along the typical characteristics that come along with a class or a hero shooter, why are we doing a cast of heroes? Why are we taking away that custom ability from the player? My only guess is marketing. It's probably easier to create a brand around a game when you have a bunch of these characters that you can put on t-shirts and your website and in the marketing, as opposed to a game that really has no lead character and is just your ominous character creator. That would be my guess. And so maybe for that reason, it's the right decision in terms of longevity of this game. It's just a little disappointing for me. In terms of the larger Bungie problems, oh boy. I wrote in my notes for the show, in the spirit of Bungie's name, maybe Bungie needs to get really close to hitting the ground before it can come back up. I don't mean that in the maybe we need to lay off hundreds of people before we can come back. It just feels like we've been receiving bad news drop after bad news drop for them, and it sounds like the company has, for lack of a better word, been spiraling and not knowing how to pull it back in to get things back on track. And maybe a shifting, not even a shifting of upper leadership, maybe having upper leadership leave, as this article talks about in terms of rumors of summer of 2026, once the final payouts are done, they peace out. Maybe that's a good thing. Whether it's because PlayStation takes over and helps right the ship and get them in a place where they can consistently create great games, or we move for other Bungie people up into that upper leadership who have fresh ideas and great direction for where this company should go, maybe that's good for the long term. But it must suck being at a company where you don't know what's going to happen after the release of your next game. And not in the way that others do, where it's like, oh, like, if I don't, like, it's gonna be iffy depending on how this game does. We don't know. If we do great, maybe we'll be huge. If we don't do great, who knows? This sounds very direct, that if the final shape isn't one of the biggest things Bungie's had in a while, there will be a lot of layoffs. It sounds as matter of fact as it can be, which is really disappointing for a company that has already gone through so much and probably just wants to make great games and then continue doing that. It sucks that it sounds like after we get the final shape, we're going to hear more layoffs. I hope that Marathon is what they needed to be. I hope it comes out and it is one of the best extraction shooters we've ever had. I still think Bungie has some of the best gunplay of any company ever. It always feels so fucking good. Those developers nail it every single time. I love how Destiny feels. And if Marathon can have that, fuck, it's in a really good place. I'm interested to see what Sam has to say about this. If y'all have any thoughts, I would love to know how you feel about the creative director change, the future of Bungie, what you would like to see from them, what you hope to see from Marathon, how you feel about the change from custom character to hero character. Moving on to our main topic. That is my review of Mirror's Edge. Guess what, folks? We're going to Wikipedia. Mirror's Edge is a 2008 first-person action-adventure platform game developed by DICE and published by EA. The game was released for PS3 and Xbox 360 in November 2008 and for Windows in January 2009. Set in a near-future city, it follows the story of Faith Connors, an underground parkour courier who transmits messages while evading government surveillance. To progress through the game, the player must control Faith from a first-person perspective and complete a series of levels that involve performing a sequence of acrobatic maneuvers, including jumping between rooftops, running across walls, and sliding down zip lines. Inspired by chase scenes featured in Casino Royale and the Bourne films, Mirror's Edge features hundreds of first-person animations to convey Faith's movement and interactions with the environment. Although the game is powered by Unreal Engine 3, a new lighting solution, which is able to reflect colors and create a lot of soft shadows, was created to give the game a unique art style. The game deliberately makes use of strong primary colors, with outdoor environments predominantly featuring white and distinctively lacking in green. The game was written by Regina Pratchett, and its score was composed by electronic music artist Solar Fields. Upon release, Mirror's Edge received generally positive reviews from critics. They praised its visuals and immersive first-person perspective, but some criticized its trial-and-error gameplay and restrictive levels. The game sold around 2.5 million units by June 2013, and won Adventure Game of the Year at the 2009 Interactive Achievement Awards. Retrospectively, it has grown in esteem and developed a passionate fanbase due to its unique style. A prequel to the game, also titled Mirror's Edge, was released for mobile in 2010. A reboot that explores a new origin story for Faith, titled Mirror's Edge Catalyst, was released in 2016. Thank you all who voted. It wasn't many of you, but the few of you who did, I hope you're listening to this episode. What did I think of Mirror's Edge? I liked it. I didn't love it. This is a game that has lived in my head since probably 2008, at latest, maybe 2010 it started, because of that art style and that first-person parkour mechanic. It was pretty revolutionary at the time, to my knowledge. I was reading through the Wikipedia page, and DICE talked about how, one, they wanted to differentiate their studio to not just be the Battlefield studio. Really sucks to see where they're at now. Really hope other studios continue to take messages from 2008. And they wanted to do something different in the first-person genre and not just do a shooter. We had not, to my knowledge, had a game like this. And for being the first of its kind, it holds up really, really well. There are issues. I will get into those. But for doing this, quote-unquote, from scratch and trying to execute on something they really hadn't done before, they fucking knocked it out of the park. It helps that this is a roughly 6-hour game. They did not get too ambitious. They did not try to create a 15-hour open world. Funny enough that the sequel would become that. Open world parkour game. They said, hey, we're going to make a tight 6-hour thriller about a runner who was trying to help save her sister. I'll get to the story stuff, which is kind of like utter bullshit that doesn't really matter. But it's all of that that is then encased inside the world that they created that I think is quite neat. And I mean, like, world aesthetic design. I think like the lore is okay, but the aesthetic design is still striking to this day. It is hard to explain to people who don't play games just how impressive this game is still today. I mean, I showed my girlfriend while I was playing. I was like, this game is from 2008. And she was like, holy shit. And it is impressive. I mean, this is one of the best looking games I've played on my Steam Deck. It looks better than a lot. It holds up than better than, I would say, probably 95% of games that came out in 2008. Looks better than probably 80% of games that came out between 2008 and 2014, 2015. It looks so fucking good. It is fantastic. The use of the stark white against these bright primary colors is so effective. Maybe I would get tired of it if it was a much longer game, but I think it's used really, really effectively across the 6-hour runtime. The choice to have it be within this supposed utopia that is actually a police-run state is really good for something like this. It is really fitting for the best parts of the game, which are the more open area chase sequences that are thrilling and exciting. They have some really good set piece choices. There's very little you can do when you create your aesthetic design around the stark white with primary colors. And they do it really well. The level in the mall is very fun. They have a level where you climb a tower. That's pretty neat. They have a train set piece. That's pretty cool. All that stuff works really well. Back to the actual parkour of it all. It feels really, really good. I was reading about the Wikipedia page, how just the ladder climbing has like 50 custom animations, which you can still tell to this day. I think the best animation they have is when you jump from a high point and you don't want to take as much damage and keep your momentum going, you can press L2 for the roll, and that roll feels and looks so good. When I showed my girlfriend, she was surprised that she didn't get nauseous or feel sick watching this, and I think that's something they nailed really well. I read in that Wikipedia page that they didn't want to make momentum realistic because it would be frustrating for players that when you're jumping from somewhere, you couldn't just like land on a small piece of wood because your momentum would carry you forward and you would die. An incredibly smart choice, and one that I think is harder to build around too, because you want to keep your player not feeling like shit. But I mean, like your actual video game player who's playing it, because if you don't match, it's kind of like the VR thing. I'm sure back in 2008, when you don't have games like this, they do a good job of keeping you in it without taking you out physically. I think the one big thing that hurts this game, and hurts any game I go back to, and I've talked about this on our Link to the Past episode, our Super Mario World episode, is it's impossible to play a game without the context of what we have now, and it frankly does hurt this game. It is impressive that it feels as good as it does now, but we have had so many fantastic developers take on parkour or really advanced first-person movement in their games that just feels better than this. Ghost Runner feels incredible. Titanfall 2 feels incredible. Games that use wall running and momentum in a way that is some of the best movement I've had in any game. And it had a lot to live up to in that this was created 10 years before that and was kind of the basis for where those games went. What I think it does work. Momentum is the best part of this game. This game is at its best when you aren't being stopped. Or at least the game isn't stopping you. Sometimes you fuck up and it ends your momentum. But the levels where you are jumping from rooftop to rooftop, sliding under things, jumping over things, it feels really good. The slide maybe is my biggest consistent problem with the game. I understand they were going for realism in that if a real life human slid under something, you don't keep your momentum, you kind of slow down, but it kills a lot of the sequences. I was desensitized to slide most of the time because it was going to kill everything I had built up in that flow state that I was in. I mean, this parkouring is kind of the definition of flow state, in which you don't want to stop moving. You want to just keep chaining together platform combo to platform combo, and the slowness of the slide kind of sucks. And that is my other biggest problem with the overall flow of this game, is stopping that momentum. There are plenty of times in these levels where they are taking faith, who I think is a pretty decent protagonist, and shoving her into a really small space where, like, you are forced to stop, look around, see what you need to do, and make a jump that doesn't feel great because you're in a super confined, dense space. I think game is at its best when you are in those open spaces and you are quickly trying to scan the environment and see, okay, where do I need to go? What is the fastest way I can get there without getting shot or without having to make the hardest jump? I think that's one thing this game does really well for 2008. I would love to see a 2024 version where you are in those open rooftop situations and there is 9 or 10 different paths you could be taking, and it is about redoing the runs or learning the best path and trial and error in the best way. This, for 2008, I still think is really good. They do a good job of, I think I talked about this with The Last of Us Part 2, where it is deceiving you into thinking there are a lot of options, but it is so well designed that it is really just forcing you into that one option. It is funneling you in the right direction. There's occasional times where the great game breaks a bit when you don't take that path and you're like, oh, this looked like the way to go, and now I'm just standing on a grate and there's nowhere to go, and now I gotta run back. And that's disappointing, and it does kill the momentum. And it results in a trial and error that I understand why it was critiqued at the time. When the whole kind of sell of this game is this parkour momentum, every time you stop, it is just a fucking knife to the heart. And that momentum is not only killed by the trial and error, but the choice of primary colors in this game is also used in a way that has become a weird controversy now with the whole yellow paint. Yellow paint is annoying. I just want to find out where to climb myself. But then sometimes you don't know where to go. This game has a weird in-between where often what you need to do is highlighted in red to show that you can, like, boost yourself up or climb it. And there are other times where it's just not. And most of the time it's pretty effective. It is put on main paths. This is the way you need to be going for the main objective. But there were times where it is not there for the main objective, and I was sitting there staring at everything near me, and I was like, I don't know where the fuck to go. And I don't think I would have felt that way had they either gone all in on the red and been like, hey, bright red, always where you need to go, or they had completely removed it, and it was, hey, you gotta find out where to go. But because it was in this weird in-between, if I didn't see the bright red, I was just like, did I run too far the wrong way? That was a little bit frustrating. I think this game should be commended that it still holds up. It's really hard for a game that not only existed, I mean, at this point, 16 years ago, to feel as good as it does now and look as good as it does, but to still hold up against games that are doing it now. Like I said, Titanfall 2, Ghost Runner, there are probably other Dying Light 2, great example, which I would argue is the parkour that feels most similar to this game's in terms of weight and speed. It is much more realistic than the more futuristic Ghost Runner or Titanfall. It's very impressive that this game still holds up. I want to move into the combat, quote-unquote, of this game. The majority of this six-hour adventure, you are parkouring. It is either running to your new objective or running away from something. I think those running away sequences are the best. It adds an extra sense of thrill when you have people shooting at you and people coming up from behind you, and you got to get to the elevator and press the button quick enough. I think the whole game should have revolved around that in, like, either more open spaces, like the indoor atriums of some of the buildings, which I think are larger scale and give you options, or the rooftops. I think those are where the games excel. Where the game doesn't excel is anything outside of the parkouring. They technically have gun combat. They technically have shooting. It's really weak, which is really funny considering this is made by DICE, who makes Battlefield, and this was their, like, we're gonna branch out and do something new, and the thing they did well was the new thing and not the thing they're good at. It essentially functions in two ways, which is there's hand-to-hand combat. You can press R2 to punch them, and you can do a jump punch or a slide punch, which is largely ineffective against most of the enemies. There is a standard enemy that has a pistol that they don't have, like, these masks on. They just look like cops. You can punch them to knockout or death. I don't know if you are killing them. The game does not specify whether Faith is a killer. My assumption based on the morality of the game is that she is not killing them. I guess that's not true. I shoot people with guns later on. Yeah, she probably is killing them. But the other side of that, besides punching and kicking, is essentially a parry that if you get close enough to them, they will always try to swing their weapon at you, and you have a short amount of time when it turns red to disarm them and knock them out. And it doesn't work how it should. They have a slowdown mechanic where you can slow down time, which makes it much easier to parry these enemies, especially the heavier heavily armored enemies. But frankly, I would slow down time, watch the weapon turn red, press the counter button, and it wouldn't work. And that happened too many times. Luckily, the load times and checkpoints are pretty friendly, so it didn't bother me too much. But anytime you got in a room where you basically needed to take out enemies in order to get to your destination, I wasn't really excited about it. Once you get the guns, unless you have a sniper, you can't really scope in, so it's just like Avatar, which is really a funny comp considering that game is, like I said, 16 years later. But it's just like from the hip shooting, which feels fine. I think the one choice they did make that I really like is the guns do not have a lot of ammo in them. You max can kill 3 people, and then you have to basically run and get a new gun from someone you killed, which I do think helps keep the momentum going. That's my main problem with adding guns in this game, is it stops the momentum. You cannot keep running and shooting. The second you have a larger gun, your speed is slowed down. I think if they could have found the way to incorporate the parry, grab a gun, keep sprinting, shoot really quickly, kill, maybe make the enemy's health lower and make their damage less, and kind of give you that power fantasy, at least for the gun portions of the game, I think it would have been more effective. I kind of already talked about level design. I think I would say 70% of the levels are phenomenal, and they are really good, singularly designed parkour zones. I think when you get into the tight interiors, it's just not good. Already talked about the aesthetic choices. It's honestly the number one thing making me want to play Mirror's Edge Catalyst. I really do like the bright white and all the colors, and the open worldness of Catalyst, to my knowledge, I think would maybe fix a lot of my problems. But then I heard what they doubled down in combat wasn't great, so who knows. The last two things I haven't really talked about are story and music. The story of this game is fine. I wouldn't go as far to say it's bad, because what would make it bad is if it was constantly shoving down my throat, and besides the beginning and end of levels, it pretty much stays out of your way, which is all I can ask for most games. I think Faith is a great protagonist. I was reading about how they just wanted to create a strong female character who wasn't, it wasn't focused on like, oh, they can shoot a gun really well. It was just like, they are like cool, and she is cool. I think she, in a different world, is a bigger video game icon. I like her a lot. As a character, she's fine, but as a design, I think she's really neat. The opening of this game, the opening setup, is really neat. It is essentially her sister, spoilers for Mirror's Edge, her sister is a cop, so they are kind of on opposing ends. She is a runner who is trying to get secret information through because the cops control everything in the city to prevent crime, which apparently there's not much of, and the runners are the main cause of chaos in the city, and her sister is a cop who, they still love each other, they're still friends, but they're on opposing sides. Her sister essentially gets framed for the murder of one of the mayors running for office, and he was basically going to change things. He was going to make things better, but he gets killed, and she gets framed for it. So it's about going through and finding out, okay, why did she get framed, who framed her, who killed the prospective mayor, etc. Really great setup. The problem is the characters are not all that compelling. The ones who are on your side don't have too much charisma or personality to fall in love with, so you're not invested in them. The villains are not interesting enough to at least get that high from them, to get that like Far Cry villain, oh, I love hearing their monologue. It doesn't reach those highs. And like some thriller mystery movies, it is trying to be a little too twisty for its own good. And when those twists happen, they don't land because you don't either know the character who the twist is for. It's like, oh, this person's bad, and it's like, I just met them 2 seconds ago. Or it's, oh, this player died, and it's like, I met them in a mission an hour ago for 30 seconds. And it is that lack of investment in the characters that results in a not very impactful story, but I would much rather take this over one that tries a lot harder and doesn't succeed, which is often what happens. Moving into the music, This is my most no comment portion of the review. It is fine. I had the sound on for maybe 50% of the game. It's funny. In a genre, specifically like first-person platforming games, often the music is so good. It is like pulsing and really motivating you to keep that momentum going, and it's just not here. It's more focused on like gun sounds and her breathing and glass breaking and all the sound effects. The sound of this game is phenomenal, but the actual music is pretty forgettable. The final two things I want to end on is, will I ever play Mirror's Edge Catalyst? This is the sequel that came out in, I think, 2015. Probably not. I say that because I don't think I want this game. Actually, let's look it up. Let's look up the how long to beat, because if this game is infinitely longer, I definitely don't want to play it, because I was very happy with this game's length, and I think it's one of the reason I liked it so much. Okay, Mirror's Edge Catalyst has 8.5 hours, 13.5 extras, not too shabby. Okay, maybe I will play it. Not anytime soon. I definitely want a break, but I think I would be interested to see how they incorporate the parkour into the open world, if they have really good collectibles, because I would fucking just skip the story and just collect everything and then quit the game. Interested if they improve the combat. From what I've heard, the answer is no, but I am curious. If you've played Mirror's Edge Catalyst, I would love to know what you think. Please message me on Twitter. And then lastly, do we need a third Mirror's Edge? This is where I change my mind and say definitively yes. I think this world is interesting enough that you don't need to change that. You can keep the existing lore you have. Two, we have come so far in first-person games, parkour games, movement. There is so much cool stuff you could do. I know you would have to drastically change the... maybe change the realism about this game. I know I just said to keep the lore, but I do think you could introduce things that I don't think would really break the audience's brain. Oh, now she's a jetpack and can do essentially a double jump. Now she can run a little faster. Now her momentum isn't killed as much. I think there are some really cool things you could do that would upgrade the parkour beyond what it's already been. I think you could, if you want to keep the gunplay, which I think honestly you just remove entirely, you make a 10-hour parkour game that is just the best first-person platformer ever made. I'm really into that, with, like I said, open areas that you have multiple choice points. Maybe instead of gunplay, if you're going to slow it down, you do stealth. I don't know how you do that, but I think there is an opportunity here to really expand what Mirror's Edge is. I mean, you look at a game like Neon White that is about constant momentum and taking out, you have to take out enemies in there, but you do it while continually moving. If you can take the energy of Neon White and to put it into Mirror's Edge, holy fuck, that'd be one of the best games of the year, I'll tell you. That's all I have to say about Mirror's Edge. I had a very fun time playing this. Very fun to check off something in my backlog. Good to know why it's a cult classic. It deserves to be one. It's really, really good. If you haven't played it, I think you should definitely give it a try. If you don't love the first 2 hours, you're not going to like the game. But if you enjoy it, you'll like the whole thing. If you've already played it, let me know what you think. I'd love to hear it. Time to move on to our rotating segment. It's another round of Hot Take Jake. What am I bringing to the table this week? Guess what? Video games need to take more from books. I don't know what you thought I was going to say, but books is the answer. I was trying to think about what, because there's all this conversation around franchise and IP, and we got to do things that are sellable. And obviously, there are a lot of books that a lot of people haven't read, and so maybe it's not the quote-unquote sellable, but one of the hardest parts about games and making them compelling is finding characterization for your main people, your main cast in the game that will attach to players and have them thinking about them and talking about them and buying shirts and buying stuff, little animals or rubber duckies dressed as characters. That's one thing that you can just, if you're going to license a book, it's already there. Two, world building, really hard. What is our world going to look like? What's the factions going to look like? What's the dynamic in politics going to look like? Already done if you're taking it from a book. I say this because Witcher, Metro, two great examples that took stuff from books that a lot of people have read relatively comparatively to other books, but it's pretty unknown. So you're not taking the risk of, oh no, if we adapt this thing wrong, people are going to be pissed. But you have the opportunity to really capitalize on something that's already there. I'm sure the licensing that IP is significantly less money than fucking licensing Marvel I would bet $1,000 on that. It seems like a place of untapped potential that if these companies are not willing to take a risk on new IP, let's start taking a risk on IP that already exists and is great and arguably is a better foundation for video games. The amount of insanely cool worlds that exist in literature right now are ridiculous. And you don't need to, I'm not saying to take a book and recreate it beat by beat. Character goes through this moment, through this moment, through this moment. That might be cool for some, but just take a world. Take the world that's something existent and create new characters and a new story. The amount of books I've read that would fit a survival game, that would fit a first-person shooter, that would fit a open world third-person game are endless. So I really think people should start trying to give that a shot. Moving on to game, watch, and listen. No game to talk about this week. I binged Mirror's Edge. Movies. James Cameron's. Why did I struggle on that? I have no fucking idea. James Cameron's The Abyss. Why do I keep wanting to say his name is James, which is definitely not his name? You get what I'm trying to say. This is his 1989 submarine thriller. And oh, and it's not a submarine, underwater thriller. It's so fucking good. This is the notorious movie about a group of, I don't even know what they are. I think they work on oil stuff, but then they get sent to basically retrieve a crashed United States military vessel. And guess what? Shit goes wrong. But it is thrilling. It is immaculately designed. I wrote in my Letterboxd review that there is something about James Cameron movies that feels so tactile. And you think about Titanic, where every single inch of that movie feels like, not that he like loved every inch, that he like bled for every inch of that movie. Apparently in The Abyss, a lot of people bled for that movie. Awful production. Ed Harris won't talk about it. But it shows. It shows a lot. There is a visceral element to this movie that you definitely don't get from stuff nowadays, but you don't get a lot of movies like this where you feel like characters are actually going to drown because they kind of were drowning. There was an amount of water in this movie that is disgusting. I don't know how they shot some of the things they did, but it's everything James Cameron does good in his other movies he does here. It's entertaining. I think the dialogue, he's been critiqued for that before. I think the way he does dialogue is straightforward and immediately compelling. He's not trying to do anything different, and it feels grounded because of that. Ed Harris, the whole cast is so good. Everyone, there are some of his like higher camp characters is a dude with a rat that reminds me of like some of the characters in Avatar. But then you have Ed Harris, and I don't remember the lead actress's name. I had never seen her in anything before, but she's phenomenal. And the build of the movie is so good. It reminds me a lot of Danny Boyle's Sunshine, which is written by Alex Garland. This feels like the underwater version of that. Sunshine takes place in space. It is set piece after set piece, high tension point after high tension point that is just like building this pressure cooker underwater to what is inevitably going to be this like big release. And sure enough, you get it. It is... really neat because the movie tries to keep it at the surface for most of the time. You get little hints of the science fiction element of this movie, but when it comes, it is completely counter to what the rest of the movie has been in a really interesting way. This is on Hulu right now. It's been really hard to find for the past few years, according to the internet. So now it's out there for everyone to see, and you definitely should go watch it because it is wildly entertaining and just a really good thriller. So go give that a try. In terms of TV, Invincible is back. This is mostly a public service announcement because Amazon sucks at advertising and promoting this show. One of the best animated shows right now. So, so, so good. And then music. Matt Champion of Brockhampton had a new album. It is a nice 35 minutes of bedroom pop. And I said to my friends, as long as your bedroom pop is relatively interesting, I'm going to love it. And it is definitely relatively interesting. So I'm a big fan. I think there's some good hooks on there. I think there is, it's just, as most bedroom pop is, it's a really good energy. It sounds like what you'd listen to if you were like up all night with your friends and you're driving through a pretty quiet area while the sun rises, and you're kind of sad because you're about to end the night, but you're also kind of happy because you've had a great time. That is what bedroom pop is to me. That's what this album is to me. I like what he's doing with his voice here. It's very raw. It's very manipulated at times. And I'm really excited to see what he does next, because I think he will continue to evolve this sound, and it'll only get more interesting from here. So that has been the Super Mojo Brothers Show. I hope you enjoyed the episode. Shout out to Mitski Kawela for the podcast artwork, and shout out to Thomniverse Remix for the music. Send any comments, questions, concerns to our email, thesupermojobrothershow@gmail.com, or our Twitter account, @SuperMojoBros. And most importantly, subscribe, leave us a review. We'd really, really appreciate it. Enjoy the rest of your day. We love you. Be kind, jump up, and be a goddamn superstar.